Hello and welcome to the Date Night Movie Podcast. I am your host, Patrick Russell, and with me is my co-host, Ashley Russell.
Hey!
On this episode, we're talking about two movies that were released straight to streaming on Christmas Day. The first is Wonder Woman 1984, which is playing both in theaters and will be available on HBO Max for about a month. The second is Pixar's Soul, which is available exclusively on Disney Plus. And, you know, so obviously these are two, like, very big budget, high profile movies that were supposed to come out back in June. But if you remember, you know, back in June, theaters were closed. And they were closed the entire summer. We literally just had an entire summer without any theatrical movies.
Yeah. That's so sad.
For me, yeah. It's real sad. Even like a mediocre, you know, summer blockbuster is better than nothing. Because it gives you something to, you know, escape the heat. It gives you something to, you know, watch and engage with and talk to other people about. It's, you know, even bad movies are still a gift.
Yeah.
Is how I look at it. And movies were definitely missed over the summer. And, you know, because this pandemic seemingly only gets worse with each passing day, these movies are available to stream in the safety of your home.
Yep.
For the price of a monthly subscription, basically.
But Wonder Woman was on HBO Max.
So, yeah, I mean, HBO Max is basically like, it's become Warner's like little digital offshoot.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, and then, you know, they made major headlines like a month ago when they announced their 2021 slate is going streaming and theaters. So that was a big shakeup. But, you know, the first one to kick that off is Wonder Woman 1984. We've been seeing previews for this for
2 years.
It feels like 2 years.
I feel like
I'm glad it's out, so we don't have to see previews.
Thank God.
But yeah, like, I mean, this movie, it's obviously a sequel to the first Wonder Woman, which grossed over $800 million back in 2017. So it was a huge hit. I mean, Patty Jenkins, known for, you know, one indie film and a bunch of TV, post-Wonder Woman, she's got her own Funko Pop.
Like, she does have her own Funko Pop.
Yeah. So, like, this was a major cultural event, this first Wonder Woman. You know, it had a 93% on Rotten Tomatoes. So, I mean, critics loved it. I remember people were upset that it wasn't nominated for Academy Awards.
They were upset that Patty wasn't nominated for Best Director. But let me tell you.
The year Guillermo del Toro won for Shape of Water.
So let me, like, just... The first Wonder Woman was good.
Was it?
However, the Justice League and Batman and the whole shebang, they have really crappy villains. And in the first Wonder Woman, it was a crappy villain.
Yeah.
I mean, the god Ares is a fantastic villain. But as depicted in the film, it wasn't...
I remember it was laughable.
Yeah.
I remember it being laughable.
Lupin.
Yeah, it was David Thewlis. Yeah. And Danny Houston was in that also, right? I remember the villains were very forgettable and ultimately kind of laughable. You overall enjoyed the first Wonder Woman. I haven't rewatched Wonder Woman since the theaters, but I found it challenging in the theaters. I found it challenging to stay engaged with the picture. It's almost 2.5 hours long. There's no real action until over an hour in. It looks kind of terrible and phony and very CGI. Gal Gadot and Chris Pine, they have some good chemistry.
They have great chemistry.
Chris Pine, arguably, is the best thing about Wonder Woman.
And Gal Gadot, I would have to say, I love Gal Gadot. I think she's a great Wonder Woman.
I think she's good as Wonder Woman. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, no, like, real complaints.
That casting was phenomenal.
Right on. Gal Gadot fits the role at 100%.
Yeah. But the villains have just been laughable.
But yeah, I expressed some skepticism about Kristen Wiig's casting, just mainly not because, like, she doesn't have the chops. Like, Kristen Wiig is a very gifted comedic actress.
Yeah.
I've seen her be very effective in dramas. It has nothing to do with, like, acting chops. There's a physicality required to this type of role in this type of movie. There's a transformation that's required.
Well, there was something, you know, Poison Ivy. Poison Ivy started off as like this geeky nerd.
I'm thinking, you know, Catwoman. I'm thinking Michelle Pfeiffer's Catwoman, well, really. But no, it felt like that's kind of what they were going for.
Yeah.
That Selina Kyle transformation.
Poison Ivy was a scientist. She was a nerd. And then
Are you thinking of like Batman Returns?
Yeah, with Uma Thurman.
I mean, that's a forgettable movie. I don't remember like all the beats of Batman and Robin with Chris O'Donnell.
Oh, whatever.
But I do remember Batman Returns very well. And I remember it doing this kind of very similar character arc.
Yeah.
Much more successfully.
Yeah. Or like Arnold Schwarzenegger's Iceman. Like, that was a good villain.
What? Batman and Robin is trash. Like, that's a trash movie. Yeah, I mean, before we really get into the film, you know, I can say, like, this movie kind of falls into the trap of other superhero sequels in that it kind of doubles up on the villains. And the best example of that working out is Batman Returns.
Yeah.
In my book, where you have Catwoman and you have the Penguin. And both are given meaty characters to play with good writing. And Batman is kind of a supporting actor next to these two. So that's a rare case where it worked. But in most cases, it doesn't. In most cases, it's overstuffed.
Yeah.
Is what happens.
I feel Marvel's got it. And Justice League and you know, Batman and that whole universe, they don't have it yet. They don't have that secret sauce.
Well, they definitely stumbled with Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, and like...
Maybe Aquaman was the best that they've had in a while.
Well, I would argue like DC has been sort of hitting its stride with Aquaman and Shazam and Birds of Prey and Joker. I mean, it seemed like they were kind of on a winning streak. I'm in the minority in that I really thought the first Wonder Woman was very disposable. I would put like the first Wonder Woman and Suicide Squad kind of on the same level.
Yeah.
I'm in the minority on that. I understand that. I think they're both kind of garbage. I was going to revisit Wonder Woman in preparation for the sequel. And every time like I thought about doing it, it's like, so many other things I can do than rewatch this 2.5 hour movie that almost put me to sleep. So yeah, I was not a fan of the first. You liked it a little bit more than me. But yeah, in this sequel, you know, we kind of swap out the World War One setting. That was one of my main issues. Like, why was the first movie set in World War One?
Yeah.
Why would you make a Wonder Woman movie where she can't fly and it's set in World War One?
See, I disagree with you on that.
Like the World War setting?
I do.
To me, it did not make any sense.
I do. I love that.
Okay.
That was one of my favorites.
I want to see Wonder Woman in a modern setting, like interacting with modern people.
This is what you got on so, this yeah, one, 1984.
This one, we're set in the 80s. It's set in DC, I think, for most of it. And yeah, this is a more modern setting. And I think right off the bat, I think the movie's more colorful than the original film.
Oh, of course.
This movie, I mean, they shot it on 35mm film, so it looks really good. There's a real vibrancy to it. And, you know, the first couple scenes, I was feeling optimistic about it. Where we get this prologue, right? Like in the Themyscira.
Well, yeah, with the
young Diana. Yeah. And that, I mean, that's a pretty good sequence. And she's really going through all these trials.
Well, and teaching her that you can't cheat life because she made a shortcut. And
heroes aren't born from lies.
Yeah.
Is kind of this movie's like through line.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that was a decent scene. I mean, it's like 10 minutes long. It's, you know, it's a little over long, but that's a decent scene. And then we get a pretty good scene like set in a mall where she's like, you know, taking down some
jewelry thieves.
I thought this was a kind of a fun scene where there's comedy, it's kind of family friendly, and there's a lot of energy to it, and I was okay with the scene.
I don't know, it kind of reminds me of Your Neighborhood Spider-Man.
It's a little cheesy, but you know, it's a little cheesy, like, but it felt
Your Neighborhood Wonder Woman.
It felt cheesy, but it felt like, okay, this is a choice, and if we're gonna lean in this direction, then that's okay. Yeah. Like, then this is what Wonder Woman is. But no, it's I mean, quickly after this scene, We're setting up the villains. I mean, this takes like an hour to set up these two villains.
So Diana and her work in the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
So
Let's stop there. Let's pause it right there. Why is Wonder Woman working in a museum?
Because it's history, and she's probably trying to find all the artifacts from her time.
But that's not made clear. It doesn't seem like she's there for any specific reason other than like I need a fucking check.
Well, it could be a place for her to hide. But she knows history.
Okay. She can't, like, lasso up into the sky and hide somewhere? She has to hide in a, like, 9-to-5 museum job?
Hide in plain sight.
This Wonder Woman chills out by having a cocktail out at a cafe just by herself.
I love it. She drinks wine. She's my heart sister.
Okay.
She's relatable.
Is that what they're going? To me, it seems very impractical that Wonder Woman would unwind in public with a glass of wine.
Nobody knows who she is. She's like, you know.
Right.
Like the Clark Kent.
It's, yeah, the whole Superman Clark Kent thing. I mean, Clark Kent working at the Daily Planet makes sense. Her working at a museum is an odd choice.
I think she just likes history. And she's like, hey, I remember this time. Because she's immortal.
And what, she's been working here for like decades?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah.
And she hasn't aged a day.
Okay, and so yeah, she's working at the museum, and one of her coworkers is Kristen Wiig.
Yep.
And Kristen Wiig is this long ass setup.
Yeah, I mean, she is, you know, geeky, clumsy.
It seems like she has a crush on Diana, honestly.
I think she's envious of Diana. She wants to be like Diana. I don't think she has a crush on her.
Maybe not. I don't know. I mean, think
she just sees that all the guys swooning, which makes sense because Gal Gadot is hot. I don't think Kristen Wiig is hot, and they try to...
They're trying to sell this. To
make her hot, and I'm not a fan of that. Like, that's why I bring up Uma Thurman. Uma Thurman is hot.
Or Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yeah.
When Michelle Pfeiffer does that transformation, Hachimachi. Yeah.
Hello.
Kristen Wiig is a beautiful lady. For me, the problem is, like, the movie is trying really hard to sell this.
Yeah.
To sell, like, her, like, edgy sex appeal.
I don't even think she's that pretty. Well, I mean, she's pretty.
I have no problem with Kristen Wiig other than, like, what she's trying to do in this role. And what she's trying to do in this role is not convincing.
She's not, like, a sexy leading lady. She's, like, the best friend.
The comedic
best friend on the side.
I feel like there's a way she could have served this movie, but, like, the movie aggressively trying to glam her up and, like, kind of nudge the audience, like, hey, pretty smoking hot, right? It was a little heavy-handed.
And then, like, her whole transformation to the cat.
Then it becomes laughable. Her performance goes from unconvincing to laughable. And I resent movies that make respectable actors look embarrassing.
Yeah.
I mean, directors, like, one base level job, don't embarrass your actors. Like, make them look their best. And when she's in digital fur in the end, like, holy cow. So it's embarrassing.
The whole basis of this movie is that they find this stone.
The monkey's paw?
The monkey's paw, or it's like the wishing stone. You know, Diana, they don't think that this stone is real. You know, Diana made a wish to bring Chris Pine back. And Kristen Wiig made a wish to make her special, to make her something different and things like that. And what they didn't realize was that the stone granted the wish, but took something away from you. So with Kristen Wiig, it was her humanity. It was her genuine niceness as a person. And Wonder Woman, it was her powers.
Does she lose her powers?
Mm-hmm. Her powers weaken. That's why she gives up Chris Pine.
Is that why she likes sipping wine at cafes?
No, that was... No, but when she couldn't beat Kristen Wiig in the White House, it was because her power was weakened. Yeah.
Okay. So yeah, a little trade-off, like kind of like a moral quandary that and it presents you.
The big main...
Yeah, we haven't even gotten to Pedro Pascal, who plays Max Lord.
He steals the stone from the Smithsonian, from Kristen Wiig's office, and says that he wished to be the stone.
I wish to be the stone, and then, yeah, like, the stone evaporates into his hands.
And so he became the wishing stone, and...
He's like a genie. He's like a make-a-wish genie going around.
But in order for him to stay alive... He has to grant a lot of wishes. And the stone is requiring a lot more stuff in return.
And ultimately, like, starts, like, taking his health.
Yeah, right? Like, he's bleeding from his ears. He's bleeding from his nose.
This is a pretty, like, batshit performance from Pedro Pascal. It starts kind of unconvincing, and then it devolves into embarrassing. Like, when he's, like, howling into, like, a green screen at the end... I don't know what the hell he's doing at the end.
Just a beam of communication.
He brings it real over the top in this scene. And that's where I felt like, okay, this is an embarrassing performance with an otherwise like very respectable actor.
Yeah.
And I don't like seeing respectable actors embarrass themselves.
And honestly, I kind of wished for this character's death I mean, because you really don't have any sympathy for him outside the fact that he's a father. And, you know, that was his saving grace, and he, quote-unquote, redeemed himself.
Well, yeah, and, I mean, you know, spoilers here. But, yeah, by the end, he's just reunited with his son, fully redeemed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
That's it.
Like, well, yeah, and so...
Like, his son should be visiting his grave.
That's what I... Or in jail or something. But
putting flowers on the grave.
But Wonder Woman couldn't defeat this guy. So what she had to do was somehow get her lasso of truth around his ankle and talk to him. But he doesn't realize that she's got the lasso of truth around his ankle. And she's talking to the masses at this point, asking them to renounce their wishes, because that's the only way for the world to survive, because all these wishes are making the world unstable. Nuclear war is imminent. Like, there is a whole bunch of stuff because the president of the United States wanted more nuclear missiles.
Do we get into all that in this movie? We get into, like, a nuclear threat?
Yeah.
I don't even know if I remember that.
You don't remember? That was the whole thing. Well,
at a certain point, I kind of started to check out of this movie. Yeah. It is 2.5 hours.
You did glaze your eyes over. But yeah,
it happens.
So that was the premise. And then she is talking to everybody through him. And, you know, with the lasso of truth, she is broadcasting the truth and what will happen to the world if people don't renounce their wishes. And so she gets everybody to renounce their wishes. And then even Pedro, the main villain, renounces his wish. So he is no longer the stone anymore to save his son.
And yeah, there's a nice little touching scene with him, you know, reconciling with his son. I don't know why we need all this.
Kristen Wiig doesn't even die in this either. Like, she has no remorse. I feel like she's going to come back as a villain in like Wonder Woman 2.
Is she left 3. As like a tiger?
No.
She like morphs back?
Yeah.
It's so dumb. I mean, we get a big dumb fight, a big dumb CGI fight with Wonder Woman and Cheetah. And it's...
Is that what her name is? Cheetah?
Yeah. I mean, apparently she's based from the comics.
Yeah.
Bad. Real bad. Like, as with the first, Chris Pine is kind of the bright spot.
Well, yeah. And, you know, he gets brought back from the dead. Well, his spirit does. So his body isn't... His spirit is stuck in some Joe Schmo's body. But she's the only one that can see his real face.
Right.
Everybody else sees the other Joe Schmo.
Right. Yeah, it's a little confusing.
And, but, you know, she is blah, 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 and love, and then she's having this conflict, internal conflict. She doesn't want to give him up.
And so, yeah, that takes up maybe like 45 minutes of them just kind of going on a nice DC date, or like a nice little montage of him trying on 80s clothes, like a fucking Ken doll.
Yeah.
So
there's also a trip to Egypt, I think, in there somewhere.
Is there a trip to Egypt?
Yeah. Because the Pedro guy goes to the oil.
Hoy.
I know. Like, it's all over the place.
There's so much to set up and like very little payoff, ultimately.
Yeah.
I mean, we get a couple of set pieces. I mean, there's there's a decent set piece with like a convoy of trucks. That she's like, you know,
well,
kicking out of the way.
Well, that was cool. Yeah.
When the movie kicks, when the movie, there we go. Yeah. Whenever this movie like shifts into action set piece gear, you know, like we did for those first two like introductory scenes, I'm feeling way more engaged.
Yeah.
And you know, in that aspect, I feel like this works a little bit better as an action movie than the first film did, because the first film for me did not work at all as an action film. Because, I mean, you need action. And this movie does have some action.
Yeah.
To its credit. It feels like it just collapses by the end.
Yeah.
The longer it goes, it collapses.
I mean, I guess, like, I don't know. I just...
People love these movies. Yeah. Like, what the fuck?
Well, I don't think a lot of people like this one. I think the kids do, but I don't think the adults do.
Well, yeah, it has like a 65% Rotten Tomatoes, you know, versus like, you know, the 93% on the first one. So
and they're not going to release their numbers until
we know it made like 16 million over the weekend, which is the biggest opening since the pandemic.
That's more than HBO Max isn't going to release it.
Or, we don't know what those numbers are.
But they're going to release it, I think.
How many people watch on HBO Max? They probably will. If it's a good number, they'll definitely brag about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it did, I guess what's encouraging is that it did pretty well in theaters.
Yeah. Considering.
Considering.
That LA and New York
LA are and New York are closed down. And it's also streaming simultaneously. It did surprisingly well in theaters. So that's encouraging. I wish it was a better film. I really wish it was a better film or just shorter. Like, you know, if we're talking like an hour 45 and the movie sustained like, you know, that kind of like kid friendly, energetic, colorful tone from like, you know, the first couple scenes, I'd be down with this movie. But it's like 2.5 hours of like nonsense.
Yeah. And there's just a lot in it. It could have been cut down a lot. Do you consider this a date movie?
It's no, but I mean the I stuff either. Between Gal Gadot and Chris Pine.
Yeah, that was cute.
That works, you know, for date night stuff. I find like the gap, like on Rotten Tomatoes, kind of interesting because to me, like it's about as bad as the first. I don't see this as like a huge drop off from the first. To me, they're both just trash.
I would give this movie a C-.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm the same. Yeah, like when you hear like Gal Gadot and Patty Jenkins talk about these films, they seem really proud of it. And these movies, they're not for me. They're not for me. They're not made for me, I don't think. I think that's what it is. They're not made for me, and that's okay. Other people enjoy them, you know, and I say that as someone whose favorite movie of the year is Birds of Prey. So I can get down with comic book, girl power action. It needs to be under 2 hours and a lot better. So yeah, why don't we take a quick break? And when we come back, we'll talk about Pixar's Soul.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, we're back, and we are going to talk about Pixar's Soul. This is the animated film that features the voices of Jamie Foxx and Tina Fey. It's directed by Pete Docter, who also made Monsters, Inc., and Up, and Inside Out, some of Pixar's best. I mean, Pete Docter has a really solid track record, I would say. So, yeah, I mean, this movie, you know, like Wonder Woman, it was supposed to come out in the summer. You know, now it's available to stream right on Disney Plus. Unlike Mulan, you don't have to pay $30 to see this. I mean, I don't know why.
Mulan was $30 and then this one wasn't.
Yeah, like for this, I would gladly pay $30. For Mulan, like, I mean, I really feel gypped. I'm still burned about paying $30 for Mulan.
But maybe that was something Disney was trying out with Mulan and then realized, probably not.
Yeah.
Not good to do that. But this was a good year for Pixar because they had Onward. They had two movies out this year.
Two original films.
I know.
Neither are franchise based. And yeah, I mean, let's take a moment of appreciation for Pixar because
Pixar changed my life with Monsters, Inc.
That was Pete Docter.
Yeah.
Monsters, Inc. is a great one. I mean, they've been producing films for like 25 years. It's amazing to like look at the first Toy Story now. I mean, it looks like something you'd see on like a local insurance commercial in terms of like the animation quality. Well,
yeah, the technology has definitely been more advanced in 10 years with animation.
With Toy Story, they could barely do human faces.
Yeah.
You look at the human faces on the first Toy Story and it's frightening. But here with Soul, here with Soul, I mean, we've really advanced and it's been interesting to watch that medium, computer animation, advance. Like year by year.
I will say what I miss about Pixar, about like the movie experience and the DVD experience and the whole shebang was that little short story.
The
short film at the beginning of,
sure.
of Pixar movies. We didn't get that in this one.
I mean, a Pixar short is, I mean, usually like...
Oscar nominated.
One of the best shorts you're going to see of the year. Yeah. I mean, not every film is at like 5-star level, but I mean, they have a really consistent track record. But I'm consistently blown away by the imagination yeah. in these films. Like, I mean, they are really, really like next level with the imagination and the creativity. The only downside has been John Lasseter.
Yeah. Didn't he like get fired or... Oh, no,
He was let go. Yeah, he was a sex pest.
Yeah, there you go.
And he was the founder of Pixar. Yeah. So that's unfortunate. But thankfully, there's a bunch of artists there, you know, with tenure, like Pete Docter, who are still leading the way with some great material. And so this film, Soul, it's ostensibly about a struggling jazz musician named Joe, who at the start of the film, it looks like he's on the verge of getting his big break after he auditions for a jazz quartet. And so immediately after this, you know, he's feeling pretty euphoric. He's walking around the town, takes place in New York City, and he falls right down a sewer well.
Yeah.
And is put into a coma.
Yeah.
And this happens before the opening titles.
Oh my goodness.
So really all I knew about this film was that it was about jazz and it also dealt with the afterlife.
Yeah.
That's really all I knew. So yeah, and so like a considerable section of this film does take place in the afterlife, limbo, I guess you could call it. And, you know, the movie refers to this kind of metaphysical realm as the great before. And here, our guy Joe, he meets 22, who is voiced by Tina Fey.
Yep.
And she's another soul in limbo.
Yeah.
Right? But she's been around for a while.
She's been around for a long time because she hasn't earned her Earth badge yet. So right. She wasn't able to go to Earth yet, even after being like counseled by, you know,
some of the great minds, right?
Minds of all time.
Right. And there's some laughs there, but yeah, I guess souls are granted Earth badges.
Yeah.
Gives them permit to like jump into a body.
Yeah. And they're like babies. Like it's like baby souls.
Right.
But they're predispositioned, I guess, at the beginning. Like if you're cranky or if you're optimistic, pessimistic, narcissistic, like it's all your personality is all chosen in this pre-life.
Right.
Or before life.
And the movie, I mean, it finds interesting ways to visualize things like lost souls.
Yeah. So this is a very mature subject for a Pixar movie, in my opinion. You're talking about the afterlife. You're talking about what's your spark. You're talking about what makes you tick.
The movie's about what drives us day to day and finding your purpose in life. I mean, that's what this movie's really about.
And appreciating life.
Well,
whether it's stargazing or, you know, the small pleasures of just eating a pizza. You know, a slice of pizza on the street or...
Well, the movie has this parable about like two fish.
Yeah.
One fish asks the other fish, like, how do I get to the ocean?
Yeah.
And the fish is like, you're in it. Like, what are you talking about? And the fish is like, this is just water. I'm looking for the ocean. And that's kind of like the metaphor for the movie, which is like, don't lose sight of where you are now.
Yeah.
Right? Because like where you are now, like you're living it right now.
Live in the present.
Live in the present. Yeah. Like that's, yeah. I mean... This is not a film that's catered for kids and its themes. I mean, you have like Tina Fey as kind of like a wisecracking buddy. And there is a section of this where it's like a mismatched buddy comedy.
Yeah.
Where they go back.
Bodies. Yeah.
But it's, yeah, it doesn't really feel catered to kids or like watered down for kids in any way. And that's one thing I love about Pixar. And also, yeah, I mean, this is an unpredictable movie. Mm-hmm. Like I did not expect... You know, like that second act twist where we go back to Earth, Joe goes into the body of a cat.
Yeah.
And 22 goes into Joe's body. And there's a whole bunch of comedy that comes from that.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like just like slapstick antics. The comedy is rooted in character.
It
and really, a lot of the comedy illuminates the character. So, yeah, this is, I mean...
This is very well done.
Really strong work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I enjoyed this movie so much. Like I said, I just feel like it's very mature, and Pixar does these mature things, and it sets up that conversation to where if you do have kids asking you about, you know, what's going on, and, you know, you can have those conversations. It's just, I guess, easy transition into those conversations.
Sure, yeah, I can see it working like that. And I, you know, Pete Docter, he made Inside Out, which visualized the way our emotions kind of work inside of us, inside of our head. And I mean, that felt kind of visionary in the way, like, that was visualized. And he does the same thing here in the way he kind of visualizes the afterlife.
Yeah.
And it makes a lot of abstract concepts digestible for the audience. Like, you can follow all of the interesting ideas that this movie's throwing at you.
And so, like, this whole thing was, you know, 22 is trying to find her spark, trying to find out what makes her tick. And, you know, she has to find that before she can get her Earth badge. And so how Joe felt like what your spark was what you do really well and what you can, quote unquote, get in the zone for. And that wasn't the case with how you get your spark. It's about appreciation of life. It's about the, you know, all these other things versus what you think your passion is, and not being consumed with that one passion, because you won't be able to have any other conversations with people outside of that passion.
Yeah. Yeah. The movie makes these points, like, it articulates them very clearly and in very entertaining ways. I mean, there's an entertaining scene at a barbershop.
Yeah.
Where we get a lot of just interesting character information that, I mean, illuminates, you know, what this guy's going through. And
the mom, I mean, when 22 is in Joe's body, you know, they go to the barbershop and they go to the mom. Like, at the barbershop, Joe always talked about jazz. That's all he talked about.
Yeah. And he never really, like, asked other people about themselves.
Mm-mm.
And
until 22 came into the body
and opened it up,
opened that conversation.
But yeah, you know, with the mom, you know, the kind of reversal with the mom at the end. I mean, I thought that was really touching.
Yeah.
When, I mean, she finally gets on board with his dream, so to speak. And she does that, I guess, after, like, speaking to Joe, like, through 22.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And after he, quote unquote, makes it, you know, he has, like, this feeling like, I thought it would feel different.
Yeah.
And then that, it's that theme of, you know, you have to find your daily spark.
Well, yeah.
And to keep you going. You have to find that thing to keep you going.
Well, and I think that
sometimes it's a moving target.
So Joe's soul, so at the very beginning, Joe's soul, you know, he goes down a pothole, and, you know, he's up and he's trying to get back to his body because he's in a coma. So he's kind of in that lingering moment where he can still get in his body, right? So they get all the antics. They finally switch back into the regular bodies. And then he gets into the zone because 22 gives him the earth badge. So he can go back to his body. So he goes back into his body, and then he realizes that it's not just about the spark. It's not just about his music. And, you know, and he realizes that why he loves music is because he shared it with his dad. He shared it with his students because he was a teacher. It was the sharing of that music was what he loved about it. And then he got in the zone, and then they switched souls. He gave 22 back the Earth badge, and then he was ready to die for 22.
But he goes back into his body?
He does, because he gets a redemption.
Right. And where does 22 go? We
don't know.
Okay.
I mean, I'm gonna.
She just goes somewhere.
Well, I'm assuming she's about to be born.
And yeah, so there's a final exchange in the film where you know, one of the metaphysical beings, they're sending him back, and they're like, "How are you going to live your life?" And he's like, "I don't know, but I'm going to live every minute of it."
Yeah.
And yeah, that's the closing line of the film. And that's kind of nicely sums up what this movie's driving message is,
yeah,
which is to just live your life in the moment. and appreciate where you're at, what you have. An amazing film.
I think it's a great date movie.
Yeah, I would say this for me, this is like top five Pixar.
Yeah.
I'll put this in like top five Pixar. And yeah, to have like two original, really entertaining, like beautifully animated Pixar films, I mean, that's a nice gift in a bad year.
It really is.
So thank you, Pixar.
Yeah.
For making two good movies this year.
A.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It's an A movie. It's a date movie. So yeah, and I guess that's it. I mean, one bad movie, one good movie.
Give and take.
You take what you can get.
There you go.
And that's our show. You can find more episodes at anchor.fm/moviedatenight, as well as on Spotify and Apple Podcasts, where you can rate and review. We're on Twitter at @DNMoviePodcast, and you can also email us at datenightmoviepodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, I'm Patrick.
I'm Ashley.
Thanks for listening.
See ya.